there, Green Future Growers. Thanks for joining us today. If you're new to the show, I hope you'll subscribe on iTunes or your favorite Android app, and let's get growing. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. So welcome to the show today, to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. And I am just thrilled to introduce this guest. Like, today is the Soil Health Day. Since I have my day off of school, I managed to book a lot of people have been very patient dealing with my schedule. And so we are really talking about soil today. And I had a guest on last year who's a garden educator who said, you have to get this woman on. She wrote a book called The Soil Will Save Us. Her name's Kristin Olson. And she's going to tell us how scientists, farmers, and foodies are healing the soil to save the planet. So we all know she's just going to fit right with our avatar, what everybody who listens to my show really cares about is how to keep our planet green. So welcome to the show, Kristin.
Thank you. Thank you.
So do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself to begin with?
Oh, what about me? You know, I come from California in a very agricultural part of California. And so really one of the strongest memories of my youth is my father and my mother and I driving around and my parents just oogling and ogling over all the things that were growing there, the fruit trees, the crops, stopping and looking at people's gardens, sometimes mortifying me by getting out of the car and taking clippings out of people's gardens. So yeah, it was a very garden friendly family.
Okay. Well, so I do, and we can totally edit this part out, but are you a millennial? Like, cause I always talk about the rock star millennials.
No, I'm old. I'm 65.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because my last guest I was talking about, she was saying, you know, that hippie generation used to be like that. And I said, well, I have this little theory that maybe that it's because the millennials were raised by the hippies. So maybe you feel more inclined to that generation or maybe completely different. So California.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a baby boomer, and I think that my parents' views on gardening really came out. So I'm a baby boomer, but I was their last child born when they figured they weren't going to have any more children. So born late in their life. And I think their views on gardening were really shaped during the Depression, you know, around World War I, where gardening, you know, meant survival. So they were always really serious about their gardens.
Okay. And so then were they organic gardeners? Or, I mean, I know a lot of people back then, it just kind of was that way. I even had a guest who came on and he kind of explained to me, he could still remember like when his dad came home and like they were all like, wow, look at this new, you know, they looked at like using, you know, chemical pesticides and things as like this brand new technology that was like, wow, this is going to change the way. And they didn't, you know, it was kind of like smoking. People didn't know it was bad for you. They were like, wow, look at this. This is going to make life easier. And we all have to grow to have our food. And,
you know, I don't really remember if they used, I mean, I'm sure they did, you know, because they were of the generation that became smitten by, you know, modern, you know, chemistry making life better, that whole idea. So I'm sure that they did use some of those things, although I just don't recall it. But they also were always very focused on their composting. So they always had an elaborate series of compost bins. You know, they were always interested in that part of it.
Okay. So is that basically like,
I always kind of start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. Like, who were you with? What'd you grow? How old were you? So you were obviously a little kid. Was it with your parents or?
Right. To be truthful about it, my first memories of gardening with my parents are just miserable ones, you know, of laboring when I wanted to be doing other things. And I especially, we used to get, this was in Oroville, California. We used to get those horrible, huge horned worms that were on the tomato plants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it used to be sort of my job to poke them off the plants and squash them. And I was just horrified by that. When I got a little older and I had a horse, then my parents prepared my first garden. You know, they got a garden bed ready for me and they said, here's where you can grow carrots for your horse. So then I became a little more interested in you know, doing my own gardening and growing these carrots for the horse. But it really was later after I was... after I was out of college and married. I got married really young and I started, you know, I first started probably with things like marigolds and zinnias in my yard and then moved on to growing food.
Okay. Well, tell us about your book.
Well, my book, so I've always had, when I started growing my own food, I was always really interested in doing it organically, even though I didn't really have a very good understanding of what that meant. And then, you know, became more and more conscious as a consumer of buying organic food. I'm a writer, so I often write about lots of different things. And I had written... for a couple of magazines about food production, you know, I wasn't really interested in writing about restaurants and I wasn't interested in writing about recipes, but I was very much interested in how food was grown. And I wrote about this one chef in Portland who had, he was a chef that I think his restaurant got started in the 80s, but I think his ideas about food were very much formed when he was younger and a teacher, and he lived in France for a while and was very impressed by how the restaurants in France reflected what was growing seasonally on the local farms. And so he wanted to have a restaurant like that. And so I lived in Cleveland then, and when he came back to Cleveland and he started his own restaurant, he really wanted to have that going on in his restaurant. But it didn't exist, you know, by that point, by the 80s, all those connections between area farms and the food that people actually ate in those areas had been broken, except for, you know, people driving out to farmers markets. And they weren't the kind of farmers market. They were farm stands along the side of the road. So anyway, he very painstakingly built up that pipeline of food from area farms to his restaurant and then to a big farmers market that started in Cleveland. So he was really a pioneer and he was just so on top of issues about food. He used to call up the members of the state legislature and complain about, you know, various bills that would impact farming. And he called up this one legislator and said, that's going to be terrible for the soil. And the legislator was like, well, what do you care? You're a chef. But he understood that connection between good soil and good food. Anyway, so he and I became friends, and he was always updating me on things that were happening with farmers and food and all of that. And one day he said, carbon farming, that's what some of these young progressive farmers are talking about. They're talking about building up carbon in the soil instead of depleting it, which is what most farming does. And so I was just fascinated by that. You know, it immediately set off this explosion of questions and connections for me, you know, knowing that global warming is the biggest environmental challenge that we face. And that, you know, part of that has to do with too much carbon dioxide being in the atmosphere. You know, what if all this farming going on over the all over the world instead of adding carbon dioxide to that load, that legacy load in the atmosphere? What if the farming around the world could start to draw that down? And you know, so I started working on the book. I started calling up some of the farmers that he told me about. I started calling up some of the scientists who were providing some of the guidance and some of the insights to these farmers. But really, it was the farmers who were making great strides and experimenting. So that was how it all got started. And, you know, of course, anything when you start off, you understand a little bit of it. And as you ask more questions and dig deeper, you know, it just opens up this whole world of other questions and possibilities. And, you know, and I'm still exploring that world.
Okay. Well, but in your book, you do a lot of traveling, right? And go explore other, do you want to talk about some of the places you went to?
Sure. I mean, I did do a lot of exploring. So, it all sort of fell into, under the category of soil health. So once I started to understand that there was a difference between what I had always thought of as good soil, you know, I always thought of good soil as being, you know, friable and, you know, rich and all that. But, you know, once I started understanding that really good soil meant that it was healthy soil, that it had this healthy population of soil microorganisms, and that when you look at plants and when you look at growing plants, you know, what you're trying to do as a gardener is to support the relationship that those plants have with those soil microorganisms. So there's like billions of microorganisms in a teaspoon of healthy soil. And those, they are all interacting with the plant, interacting with each other. And all those activities, those are the way that those are the ways that plants get the nutrients that they need. That they, that's the way they've always gotten the nutrients that they need. You know, if you look at a meadow or a forest or, you know, any natural area where plants are just growing like mad, it's not because somebody threw fertilizer out there. It's because that relationship that they have with the microorganisms is bringing them the nutrients that they need. And it's how they combat disease, you know, plants and microorganisms together combat disease that breaks down that whole system, that symbiosis. And the plant's relationship with those microorganisms also leads to soil being the kind of soil that is that has pockets in it so that water can stay there. It's well-engineered soil, and it's the microorganisms that do that. Engineering, that microengineering of soil. So anyway, that's what we do. That's our best role as gardeners, is trying to help that relationship between plants and soil microorganisms. So there are all sorts of ways to look at that, you know, all sorts of ways that people are doing that around the world. So, you know, one of the trips that I took in the book was that come up with the material for the book was I went to Zimbabwe, where Alan Savory, who's a biologist and a former land manager, he studied how lands become degraded when humans change the behavior of animals on the land. So he was looking at that in Africa. But if you look at an example here in the United States, you know, you look at the herds of buffalo that used to travel over the Great Plains, you know, immense herds of buffalo. Well, the soils of those lands now, you know, those are highly coveted soils. Farmers really want to farm in those soils. And the reason that they are such great soils was of this bigger interaction between plants and soil microorganisms and animals. That animal impact on the land was really important. And the way those animals moved over the land before humans started to interfere with that was that they traveled over the land closely bunched together because they wanted to protect themselves from predators. And they, you know, sort of traveled on at a steady pace, again, because they, you know, were sort of constantly on the move to keep away from predators, and because they didn't want to eat their own, you know, dung and urine. So they just kept moving, and their hooves pocked up the land a little bit so that rain could break down in, and their hooves also trampled down vegetation into the soil so that those soil microorganisms could get at it. And they also, you know, bit down the grasses and the forbs and other things. They bit it down, but not to the soil line. They bit it down partially, and then they moved on. So it was a really healthy impact on the land. So he has, you know, Alan Savory came up with this idea of holistic grazing, you know, which is grazing that mimics that natural pattern of animals on the land. So that's one way that people are building soil health around the world. I think the place where it really all came together for me was in, of all places, North Dakota. You know, I went and visited some farmers in North Dakota, and sort of the superstar farmer in my book is a guy named Gabe Brown, who like 15 years ago, 16 years ago, he had bought a farm. He had bought the farm maybe 20 years ago. And then he had like these 4 years of terrible, terrible weather conditions. You know, 1 year his crop was wiped out by hail. Another year it was wiped out by frost. Another year it was wiped out by drought. So he had 4 years where he had no crop to take to market, and he was in danger of losing the farm. And so he started to really change the way he did things, you know, and some of the reason that he changed was just because he couldn't afford all those chemicals that he used to use. He couldn't afford the chemical fertilizers. He couldn't afford the pesticides and the herbicides and the fungicides and the fly chemicals that keep the flies away from the animals. He couldn't afford all that stuff. And he really couldn't even afford the diesel for his machine. So he really cut back on all that stuff. So he became a no-till farmer. That was the first big change that he made on his land. So, you know, if we don't think of the earth as the soil as a living ecosystem, then we don't realize how devastating tillage is. But if you imagine that the soil is a living ecosystem with these billions and billions and billions of microorganisms making their homes there, you know, engineering the soil to protect, to make little protected areas for themselves and to control the flow of water and gases in the soil. If you look at the soil that way, that it's this, it's a community that's kind of like a coral reef, then you can understand when a big plow comes through and churns the soil up a couple of feet, that it's kind of like Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans every time there's tillage. So he started to understand that, and he actually, he didn't even understand why it was a good idea completely. He just observed in his fields that that tillage made his soil really dried out and unhealthy. And so he decided he was going to stop tilling. So he became a no-till farmer. And then he had his, you know, his 4 terrible years where he had to cut out all this other stuff that he was doing just to hang on financially. And what he started doing was, instead of using machinery to remove that ruined crop that was out in the field, he would send his cattle out into the fields and have them chew down and stomp down that ruined crop that was there. And he started noticing that his land, his soil was just becoming more resilient, that he started having fewer problems with it, that he started, you know, when there were dry periods that his crops would hold up, whereas his neighbors were falling over. And then he started, you know, and this is the stuff that I love, you know, that there are these, just as there are these really incredible, affirming, life-giving partnerships between plants and soil microorganisms and animals, you know, he began a very fertile partnership with a couple of scientists, with Chris Nichols, who's now the head of the science director of the Rodale Institute, but at that point she was a soil scientist working for the USDA near where he was farming. And Jay Fuhrer, who's a conservationist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is another USDA agency. So he started working with them to try to understand what was going on with his soil and to try to, now that he had seen that he didn't necessarily need all these chemicals and all this tillage and all these things he had been taught in ag school. So he started working with them on how to push this idea of working with nature, respecting nature, you know, farming by understanding these partnerships, these relationships that exist in nature. So he started working with them on how to push that farther and farther. And so, you know, one of the things they started doing in that area, they had heard a scientist from South America, and I can't remember his name right now, but they had heard him talking about cover crops, and he was talking about an idea in cover cropping called cover crop cocktails. So cover crops are what farmers have used for millennia to protect soil during fallow periods. So you know, when you're out driving around, I mean, I see it so much here in Oregon. If you get on the highway and there are these, you know, going through the Willamette Valley and there are farms on either side, well, they're, you know, they're bare fields on either side. You know, those are farmers who tilled and cleared their fields after their last crop in the fall, and they won't get out there to work that field again until, I don't know, May, April. So it's months and months that soil has just been naked and it's exposed to the air, you know, the carbon that's in the soil volatilizing and drifting away as carbon dioxide. And that soil being subjected to wind erosion, rain erosion, all those forces that are just so bad for it. You know, soil, nature never intended soil to be naked. So cover crops is really an idea that has come back now that more and more scientists and farmers are understanding that what a plant does, you know, part of what a plant, how a plant services that community of microorganisms in the soil that the plant relies on for nutrients and for water control and all that, is that plants are continually pumping out a carbon, what I call a carbon fuel, a carbon-based fuel to those soil microorganisms. So plants, through photosynthesis, are making a carbon-based fuel for themselves. So they use that carbon-based fuel, those sugars and carbohydrates and proteins, to, you know, build their trunks and build their stems and build their flowers and build their fruits and build their roots. But up to half, and sometimes more and sometimes less, of that carbon fuel is leaked out through the roots specifically to feed those soil microorganisms. So these scientists and these farmers, understanding more and more about that community of microorganisms in the soil and how important that relationship is for anything to grow, for any plant to grow, they started understanding that it's a terrible assault against nature when you have those bare fields for 6 months. So they started really investigating and investing in cover crops, putting a cover crop over those fields. So you know, and more farmers are doing that, although it's still only around 3% of the nation's farmers that do that. So more and more farmers were using cover crops, but then this idea from South America was, well, you know, plants, it's kind of like there's a big church potluck, and, you know, you have... I'm using a funny analogy that I'm making up right now. So it's like a big church potluck, and you have 100 women named Betty that are bringing a chicken casserole. But they all make it a little differently. You know, some of them put in olives and green peppers, and some of them put in tomatoes and cheese, and some of them, you know, it's a little different depending on which Betty made it. And it's kind of that way with different plants. You know, different plants, their exudates, that carbon fuel that they leak to the soil microorganisms, is going to be a little different. So the idea for this cover crop cocktail thing is, you know, just like creatures above ground that prefer one kind of food over another, one of the Betty's casseroles versus another one of the Betty's casseroles, these soil microorganisms are the same way. So let's get lots of different plants with roots going into the ground for these cover crops. Let's get, instead of two or three plants that we're covering the fields with, let's get 10 in, let's get 15 in, let's get 50 in, let's get 60 in. So some of these farmers are now experimenting with cover crop cocktails where they have, you know, 60 different cover crops in a field, in fallow fields, and sometimes in the rows between their regular crops. So if they're growing corn, they'll have what the cover crops in that case are called companion crops, and they'll have these companion crops growing alongside. So that the idea is to never have bare soil, and the idea is to have as much plant biodiversity there as possible. And then, you know, when they bring in their animals to eat the remnants of the cover crops, or the remnants of the cover crops and the market crop, you know, that's also some animal biodiversity coming in there, more biodiversity. So the idea is just, you know, have the soil covered all the time, have as much biodiversity there as possible. Anyway, these farmers and the scientists that they're working with are just endlessly creative at coming up with ways to make soil healthier, to observe nature, to try to respect nature, you know, because farming that we've practiced, well, really ever since humans started to farm, which is some 10,000 years ago, but especially in the last 100 years, with you know, the kind of mechanized tilling that's more and more destructive and invasive than it ever was before, and the kind of all the kind of chemicals that we employ in conventional agriculture, and all the, you know, the impacts that the highly engineered seeds have, you know, the high-tech seeds have, all those things really subvert the natural process. So these farmers are really trying to understand how nature grows things and to work with that.
Awesome. You know, I interviewed this woman, Liz Carlisle, who wrote a book about basically like why only 3%, you know, that was her big question. She's like, she was like a PhD student.
Right.
Down at
I read
Berkeley.
Her book.
And like getting her PhD in like geography or something obscure, but yeah. And she really goes into, you know, why is it, if we know this is the best practice, why aren't people doing it?
Well, I recently wrote an article for ENSEA.com, which is an online environmental magazine about that question, because yes, so many people do recognize it as a best practice. Yes, it's something that the Natural Resources Conservation Service is really pushing with farmers. So why aren't more farmers doing it? Not only, I mean, I think the really big question is, you know, there are all these farmers like Gabe Brown and some of the farmers that I wrote about in my book that are, it's not just that they're environmentally successful. You know, it's not just that they're producing a crop right. that is not only not hurting the environment, but is nourishing the environment. So it's not just that they are successful that way, but they're also really successful financially. You know, they're not spending all that money on chemicals, you know, which is a huge amount of money. And they are, many of them have greater production than their neighbors do. You know, I think that they're showing that once you get that natural system going, once you understand how to work, you know, how to produce a crop in collaboration with nature, and that natural system sort of gets established again, that you're not fighting nature all the time. You're able to produce more. You have greater disease resistance. You have greater resilience to bad weather. You know, so in the face of that, why aren't more farmers doing it? And one of the things that I found when I was researching this article is that a lot of our government policies don't support them doing that. So most of the big farmers in this country, I would say all, except that I'm sure that there are some who aren't, get federal crop insurance. And that's something that the taxpayer subsidizes very, very, very heavily. So farmers don't have to pay much for it. And they're sort of guaranteed a price, a profit. And so that's really important to farmers. You know, they can't get a they often can't get a bike loan, a bank loan. I just looked at my bike and said bike. They can't get a bank loan.
That's okay.
Without that federal crop insurance. And, for these big farmers, it's absolutely essential for them to have it. It's what keeps them, it's what allows them to sleep at night, you know, when they start a growing season and they're not sure if they're going to hit by another big drought like we had in 2012. The crop insurance rules are really sadly out of date. They're not up with the new science and the new experience of farmers that are really trying to work with nature. They are very much informed by sort of the old conventional chemical mindset. So there are all these bad practices, bad farming practices, you know, bad for the food, bad for the farmer, bad for the land, bad for the environment that farmers can do, and they can get their crop insurance, you know, they can get their crop insurance payout if they have a problem. But there are They often get kicked out of crop insurance if they're using cover crops in ways that aren't that don't fit the micromanagement of that agency. So there are all these weird, I think we always think that, well, farmers aren't doing these things because it's too hard or they can't make money doing it. And that's not the reason they're not taking up these practices. You know, some of them are just really stupid obstacles that we need to get rid of right away.
Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Hey, Green Future Growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Did you know that you could support the Organic Gardener podcast without doing anything differently? If you're going to buy something on Amazon.com, since I'm an Amazon affiliate, if you go to Amazon through a link on my page, which every book that is listed on my website is linked to Amazon.com, you don't have to buy that book, but anything you buy that day from Amazon will give me a very, very small commission, but I got to tell you, it would sure help pay for, you know, just some of the basics it costs to keep the podcast up there. And now let's get to the root of things.
Well, let's talk about so do you have a garden?
I do. I have a tiny little yard here. And it's so interesting. I kind of thought that Ohio and Oregon, you know, because they both start with O and because they both get a lot of precipitation and that gardening here would be very much like gardening there, and it's really different. So I'm learning a lot about those differences and what grows better here. So I have a small yard, and when I first bought this house, it was just baked grass, you know, pounded down grass, kind of baked. There had been a boat stored in the yard. You know, the yard is not much bigger than the boat, but there had been a boat stored there. So it was not a very great spot to begin gardening, although it was, you know, great because I could start from scratch. So I put in, you know, lots of shrubs and some dwarf fruit trees, some blueberries, huckleberry, So I've got that going, and I have a couple of raised beds because I also have two dogs that come out into the yard with me every once in a while, although I don't let them out there that much because they rampage around and knock everything over. But I put in these two raised beds because I didn't want them walking in my vegetables. So I've got, you know, a lot of things going in those two beds. That's been really fun. You know, because one thing that you can do here in Oregon that I couldn't do in Ohio was have things growing through the winter that I could eat. So, you know, really the best part of my day every day is going outside first thing in the morning and peeking around to see what I can eat, you know, and there's almost always something there. There's, you know, my kale plants and my collards are still produced new leaves all throughout the winter. Right now my garlic and my chives and my, parsley are starting to produce again, other greens that persisted through the winter. So, you know, it's been really fun to keep sort of nibbling at the things that are growing out there.
How about, is there something you're excited to try different next year, maybe that you haven't done before or something new?
You know, there's a wonderful garden supply store near me, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what kind of vegetable starch she has. I recently became, or in the last couple of years, became acquainted with Frank Morton of Wild Garden Seeds. You should interview him. Oh my God, he's such a fascinating guy. Oh, okay, he's such cool. A great guy. So I did an article about him a couple of years ago. He's an organic plant breeder and seed salesman. So he, you know, he's mostly growing seeds that farmers buy, that farmers that supply our farmers markets buy. So I think he often sells them in quantities that would be way too much for me. But I'm really interested in trying some of his things. He has a whole line of red lettuces. He's enamored with red. And it's so funny. He started breeding just for his own pleasure. He started really – so what he does is he makes selections from – you know, different varieties that he's grown that have gone to seed. And he makes selections based on the ones that he likes the best, that perform the best, and that he just likes the best, and that he likes the flavor of, and all those things. But one of the things that he was always really attracted to was color. So he has like 35 different varieties of red lettuces. And one of them is being grown on the space station because it's so antioxidant rich. It's just like super, super healthy. So, you know, that was something that he didn't realize, that the more intense the color is on these vegetables, the more antioxidants they have. So they turn out to be really good for us too. He was just doing it because he thought they were beautiful. But he has a catalog of really great, great seeds and plants that I would like to try some of his.
Awesome. I always have a preference for red leaf lettuce over green leaf lettuce. I don't know why that is, but I have been told that it's one of those more nutrient dense vegetables that are just a little bit healthier for us.
And I know some of the plant breeders out here were working on a new variety of purple. And again, these are all plants that are, so they're organic seeds. And the whole idea behind that is, you know, when I first heard about, you know, that there were people working focused specifically on organic seed, I kind of thought, well, what's the big deal with organic seed? I mean, isn't it the way you grow it that makes the difference? You know, if you're growing it organically, does it matter how it started out? But it really does matter. You know, one of the things I learned writing this article was that, conventional seeds, you know, the non-organic seeds, those are from plants that expect to have chemical fertilizers, that expect to have chemical pesticides, that expect, you know, they don't have, they're not naturally resilient. They're not naturally good at foraging and working with those soil microorganisms for nutrients. They're not naturally good at repelling insects and disease. They're not naturally good at foraging for water. So these organic plants that then, you know, people are selling the seeds to, those are plants that have flourished without chemical fertilizer. They've flourished without any kind of pesticide. So they're, if you want to be an organic gardener, you're giving yourself a leg up by having these organic seeds. So that's another reason that I really want to try out some of those seeds.
Excellent. Well, that's been one of the big things I've learned since I started my podcast. Like we always just bought new seeds. Like I always bought new seeds every year, and like the importance of saving your seeds. And then also, like you were saying, like picking the best ones, like the ones that produce earliest. If you live in an area, like I do, like in the Rocky Mountains where, you have a short growing season, you know, you want to find those ones that are going to come up the earliest so that, and then each year they'll get a little more. Like I didn't know any of that before I started mm-hmm. my podcast. And then, the other thing that you were saying that I was thinking about is, one of the guys in Liz Carlisle's book was that Bob Quinn who sells, what's it called? Not an heirloom wheat, but a mm-hmm. ancient wheat, a Camut. He has this Camut wheat, patent. And he, like, that was a big thing when I interviewed him that I really liked, was he talked about it from a profitable sense. You know, he's not into organic because he's in a kind mm-hmm. of a hippie, you know, he cares about the environment for sure, but he talked a lot about getting into it because it was just the, financially, it was the mm-hmm. way to go, you know, and not having to buy those fertilizers like you were saying. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, I know you're in a hurry. So is there anything that we've forgotten that you wanted to mention or that I didn't talk about?
If I were better prepared, I would have some idea. You know, there's this whole thing about the French initiative, but I don't have the details in my brain enough right now to come up with them. Do you know about the French initiative?
The thing in Paris with the new mayor that wants to, what is it?
No.
Is that what you're talking about?
No.
No, okay. I guess I don't then. That's so interesting because exactly a year ago today, I landed in Paris the first time of my life to celebrate. Last year, I was at 100,000 downloads of my podcast, and this year, I just broke 250,000 downloads. So last year, I went to Paris to celebrate.
Oh, that's great.
So that's what a way to celebrate. But no, I don't know anything about the French initiative. Yeah, it was amazing. I've just been, it's been in my thoughts so much the last month.
Okay. At the recent Paris climate talks back in 2015, France and 100 governments and nonprofits launched something called the 4 per 1,000 initiative, which calls for an increase of carbon in the world's soils by 0.4% per year. So it's a small boost, but if it were done over all the farmlands in the world, it could, you know, not only really radically improve soil fertility and food production, but also halt the annual rise of atmospheric carbon dioxide. So this is, you know, the whole idea tackling our climate problem by tackling our soil problem, our depleted, unhealthy soil problem, is one that's just becoming bigger and bigger, a bigger part of the conversation worldwide.
Excellent. I think that was it. Was about Paris fighting climate change. Was what it goes like this. So if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Well, you know, I think it's our there's so many things, but I think it's our agriculture. You know, our agriculture, the way it's practiced in such a way that it makes our land sicker, our water sicker, our people sicker. I'm really excited by the whole Plate of the Union initiative.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your book with us. And I will put the links to your website and your book and everything in the show notes. And just have
a wonderful thank you. You too, Jackie. Good to talk to you finally.
I know. Sorry, it was a little hectic too.
That's all right.
So, well, you have a great day.
If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.